Blog
Good morning.
Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to NJSBA's podcast program, Conversation on New Jersey Education, a program designed to give you a chance to listen and communicate with state educational leaders. If you want to participate in the program, you can dial 1-347-989-8904 and just press 1. And that will let Mike, who's monitoring our switchboard, know that you have a question and get the question on to me so that I know what the topic is. Or you can just log into our chat room. You have to register with Blog Talk Radio, but there's no fee to do that. And you can just type in your question in there, and I'll pass it on to our guest. Today, I'm looking forward to this conversation I'm going to have. We're going to be talking with representatives from the NJSIAA, New Jersey State Interscholastic Athletic Association. Nothing probably is more integral to our high school than our sports programs. They generate a lot of interest among the community. So with me is Larry White, who's the executive director of the NJSIAA. Welcome, Larry.
Welcome, Ray. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, and also with us is Steve Schofield. Steve is a school board member and vice president for the NJSIAA. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having us on today.
No, my pleasure. Okay, a lot of times we've heard of the NJSIAA, but Larry, what is what's the mission of NJSIAA?
Well, we have about 10 statements in our constitution and bylaws that adhere to the mission of NJSIA. Very quickly, without really focusing on any one, but our number one mission is a safe and healthy playing environment is essential to our mission. Participation in our interscholastic athletics embraces the educational experience of all students. Interscholastic athletics is a privilege. Excellence in both academics and athletics is pursued by all. Rules promote fair play and minimize risk. Cooperation among members advances their individual and collective well-being. Properly trained officials, judges enhance interscholastic competition. And NJSIA is the recognized state authority in interscholastic athletic programs. I didn't go all through all 10, but I think that will give the audience a little bit of an idea of what we're all about.
And who makes up the NJSIA? You know, who are its members and how is it governed?
Well, the 433 public, parochial, and private high schools really make up the NJSIAA, and the association is governed by a 49-member executive committee that is comprised of superintendents, principals, athletic directors, and other major stakeholders that represent other constituencies in the educational fields. At this point, Steve, if you want to jump in and, you know, you can give maybe a little bit more in-depth into that question because you are one of those that make up our board and you can tell from where you came from.
Right. I'm one of the New Jersey School Board Association representatives to the executive committee of the NJSIAA. And as Larry said, it's a committee of about 49 or 50 people, individuals who are various stakeholders in high school athletics in New Jersey, coming from a wide range of perspectives. You have athletic directors on there. You have, of course, a lot of former coaches. You have school administrators like principals and superintendents. Then you have people like me that are coming from maybe a board of education position, or other positions involved in secondary education that have some background and some knowledge of high school athletics. And it's a large group, but it's a very, very well functioning group, and a lot of different points of view and a lot of knowledge, a lot of combined knowledge. Is evident every time we get together, which is about once a month.
Okay, and just all the sports programs and all the high school, that's a lot of events that go on through the course of the year. But let's talk about even having your organization have to monitor all these sports. What's the importance of athletics that you feel in our education environment?
Well, I can tell you and everyone that's listening, athletics has been a part of my life since I was 7 years old. I grew up in a small South Jersey town of Penns Grove, New Jersey, and at age seven, we played farm league baseball. No names on our shirts. Just I remember being on the Purple People Eaters team with purple shirts and purple hats. But I mean, from there, I went on to play 4 years of high school athletics, 4 years of college baseball, and 3 years of sub-varsity basketball at LaSalle College. And then I turned into teaching, coaching, officiating, and I mean, I look back on it and say it all prepared me for this particular position that I have today. After 12 years of being an assistant director here at NJSI, I was fortunate enough to be given the head position as executive director last year.
Steve, any comment on the importance of
officiating?
Because you were a teacher, too.
Right. I was. I taught and coached. Well, I taught for 38 years. I coached for 25, and now I'm on the teaching at Kane University. But the importance of athletics in public education, I don't think can be overstated. A properly run athletics program, it's a vital part of a comprehensive educational program. It should be an extension of the classroom. Larry will probably remember Ernie Finizio, who was the superintendent at Roselle Park and then later was an assistant director at the NJSIA. And Ernie always used to talk about the three A's, academics, athletics, and the arts, and how they were all vitally important in a comprehensive educational program. I think athletics enables kids to experience learning situations that can't be duplicated in the classroom. And for some kids, for me, also this proved true. It provides a pathway to higher education, and I'm not just talking about D1 athletes. I'm not talking about elite athletes going to big time programs. For a lot of kids, athletics is the pathway to higher education, as it was for me. And I had a remarkably mediocre football career at Kane University, but it paved the way for me to go there. So and really, athletics, I think, oftentimes is a catalyst for overall school pride and school spirit. So I think it's really important.
And Steve, you're absolutely right. I mean, and the other thing, though, it's, you know, it teaches you those core values like perseverance and diligence, teamwork, you know, sacrifice. For the common good, for the team, and not just for individual honors and things like that. I mean, that was so tremendously important growing up. Then that you started to realize you had to work together. You know,
right.
No one person was bigger than the team.
Exactly.
Okay, let's go on to some of the issues that I think most people would agree with you. I agree with you because I had a equally mediocre football career as Steve. That being said, they're, you know, managing all the sports programs must be tough. I've heard, I know recently we just had a little ruling on this. I'm an athlete in the school district. We don't have enough kids to field, say, a football team because that takes a lot of kids. What are the options that the school has and or the student?
Well, NJSIA, for the many years that I was here as an assistant director, you know, we have a system where schools that have declining population in a specific sport has the opportunity to co-op or cooperative sports programs with another school that's, you know, somewhat in the same situation. Their numbers are okay, but probably need a little help. So we've actually expanded that this past year by allowing even all of our sports for schools to co-op in. Before, we had about four or five sports that we did not allow, but we've since changed that. We've had a committee that sat about three or four times. So now we've expanded the co-op. It's I think it's a great thing because now we really should see, hopefully the schools take advantage of it. And as far as the students, our basic rule is that you play the sport at the school in which you're enrolled. I mean, that's kind of fundamental. But we also realize that there are vo-tech schools, magnet schools, charter schools that may not have sports programs or not have the sport program that, say, Larry White wants to compete. And we do allow, with the principal's agreement from both schools, that student-athlete could come from the vo-tech school and come back and play at the home school. And our membership has, you know, said that that's a great thing. And I agree.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
and I think
the needs
also, if I may, I just want to I'll ask Larry this question because I think we I'd have to defer to you on this, Larry. But if a school doesn't have a particular sport, say track and field or diving, swimming with a diving team, and an individual student wanted to participate on the state level. Even though his school doesn't have a team, he can. I believe there's been times where we've let people enter as individuals, right? As long as they've been accompanied by, they'd have to be accompanied by a staff member.
It depends on that sport as to whether or not there is an individual component to the state tournament. Bowling is a sport where obviously we have team bowling, but if I go to a school that doesn't have a bowling team, I can still then compete in the individual championships that we run pretty much alongside our team championships. We have girls team bowling championships. We have boys. And then from that, we then take our maybe 50 top highest average bowlers, and that may be a student athlete that doesn't have a team sport, but because he or she bowls in a youth league, they have to get a certain average with so many games played. And if they do, then they can come in and qualify. I actually believe that 2 years ago, the state champion boys bowler was from a school that didn't have the program, but he was just a phenomenal bowler.
Right.
Wow. Okay. So that would be for individual sports like in track and field where you have the – hurdles and pole vaulting and all those others where there's an individual, not a team sport, obviously.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, sports where there's an individual component to the sport. You know, it could be a track and field team championship as well, but then there's individual tournaments that are run alongside in certain sports. So those are the sports that would be applicable to a situation like this. But I think the bottom line is that, you know, we try to make opportunities available to student athletes in as many ways as we can.
Okay. And in a totally different, maybe some of the biggest things is the championships in each group and in each section of the state. And I've heard concerns about sometimes the fees that are charged, particularly for football and wrestling. How do you arrive at the fees for a tournament event?
Well, let's talk about what tournaments you're referring to, Ray. County or conference tournaments or the NJSI state tournaments?
The state tournament, yeah.
The fees that we come up with, first, we have to submit our request for the fees to the Department of Education. Several years ago, there was a law passed that now says we have to run our fees by the department. There's a formula that we have to adhere to. I mean, you know, lately we've seen a lot of stuff about these private showcase tournaments that are, you know, sponsored by, you know, individuals or corporations, and, you know, some of their figures are outlandish, at least if you ask me. County and conference tournaments, they're set by the county and conference, and for the most part, the adult fees are $10, $15, which, you know, we tend to think that's probably reasonable. However, our fees are less than that, and it's one of the way that we generate revenue and right now. It's a situation where, you know, bad weather conditions for football can certainly affect our revenue stream.
Okay. Now, in recent years, and this is at the pro level and college level, we've had a lot of concern about the health and safety of our student athletes or athletes in general. And I know this has been an issue for your association. Let's take a look at a few of them. First of all, let's go to concussions, because I think that's been in the news so often. Is there any – and I know you recently did a ruling on the amount of practice time for football. So how are you addressing the issue of concussions as an association?
Well, going back to, I believe, the years 2010 – we were one of the first states, if not the first state, to really come up with a comprehensive concussion policy and a concussion return to play policy. We attacked it from the idea that the officials, being right there on the field, on the court, that they needed to be trained so that they could detect the signs, symptoms, and behaviors consistent with a concussion. Because, like I said, they're first responders. Right there, kid gets tackled, officials right there, looks into the kid's eyes and can just tell, you know, whatever. So we instituted the policy that they would then beckon, call timeout, beckon the athletic trainer, coaches out to the things and say, "Coach, this young man, he's exhibited the signs, symptoms consistent with a concussion." They would remove him. And then we devised a return to play form that would have to be signed off by a MD or a DO, and only the signature of one of those professionals would allow that student to return to play that game or that practice right then. If they didn't return, then they have to go through the lengthier program. Some use Impact, some use other ones before they could be cleared to come back and participate. And that was, like I said, that was pretty much groundbreaking at that time. We had great support in the state legislature, and I was the point person because I was in charge of the officials. And as I go around the state, we made sure that the officials had to take this course every year or else they would not be able to officiate. And I was very, very pleased to say I never received one of those return to play forms signed by a doctor in the years that we've been doing this. And even now as the executive director, I'm not aware of us ever getting a form.
Wow. And so did you, and when you said DO, what's a DO? As a
Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine.
Okay.
I mean.
Right. In the concussion policy, in the NJSIA concussion policy, it's written right in, only a physician trained in the evaluation management of concussions can sign off on a written clearance that would allow a concussed player or a suspected concussed player to return to play.
Right.
So, yeah, I think the NJSIA is real diligent in this area, as it is in many other areas in terms of player safety.
Did you have to also do some training for the coaches on this besides the officials?
Yes. After a couple years after the officials were required to take this course or to take a course, because there are different ones, the NFHS, the National Federation of High Schools, the parent group of all the state associations, you know, they had a course, but the Center for Disease Control down in Atlanta, they have a course. We accept any of those courses. We mandated that the coaches had to take a concussion course, and that's also, they have to do that every year.
And is this for all sports or just the contact sports like,
Nope. All sports.
All sports.
All sports.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, because you don't think about it. I mean, maybe being a, a sport where there's, contact or anything like this. But, volleyball, girls volleyball. I've seen somebody kill, you know, using that term meaning like, you know, to spike the ball, hits girl
right
in the face, and just, you know, athletic trainer's right there. Come on, got to go out. Doesn't return.
Okay.
So.
All right.
We once had a concussion injury, believe it or not, at Johnson Regional when I was teaching back there. We once had a concussion injury occur in girls tennis, believe it or not. So it's rare, but it can happen.
Yeah.
And so it's more than just football.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I guess you could also fall and hit your head. So that
it's
common. Let's look at another issue is steroids. Is there anything that you do in that area? I know you because that's sometimes an issue with athletics.
Back around the same time as the concussion, maybe a little bit before that, though, New Jersey, NJSIA was the first state, and as of right now, I believe we're still the only state that does random steroid testing. It's random in the sense that teams that make the state tournament can be randomly chosen to go through our steroid testing program. For years, the agency that we work with was called Drug Free Sports, located out in Kansas, and I believe their lab was out in L.A. Or out in California. We still do it. We test roughly 500 student-athletes over the fall, winter, and spring sports. It's random as for the teams, and then once a school is chosen, and let's just say they're going to randomly test the football team, the school must send in a copy of their rosters, freshmen through seniors, and then that roster is randomized by number, and then they will just say, okay, the number 2 kid on the roster, the number 6 kid on the roster, so forth and so on. And they may test, you know, 8 students from that school, and usually maybe 6 or 7 or 8 schools will be tested. But so we've been doing that, and we still continue to do it. Thankfully, the state legislature, they allocate us $50,000 to do it, and we also put in $50,000. So for that $100,000, we get about 500 students that we will randomly test.
Oh. And the other issue that has been come up, in particularly in recent years, is opioids, you know, the painkillers after an injury or something to that effect. Is there anything that you try to do in that area in terms of training coaches or anything?
Not sure that we do a lot in training the coaches, but we have just signed an agreement with the Attorney General's Office of New Jersey through their NJ Cares division, and we are working together to create some video that we will then have the student athlete and the parents view and sign off on. We're looking to roll that out in time for this coming fall's season, and then we will make sure that they have to do it for all of the sports that they play. And, you know, just to get the word out that, it's, you know, back in the day when, you know, came off the field and you were hurting, coaches would kind of use that old cliche about suck it up and, you know, get back out there. Well, you know, we're starting to realize now that it may not be the best way to handle this. And, you know, these opioids, the painkillers, it's really it's horrible. So we're, you know, we're on the forefront of that movement also. Steve, you have anything that you want to add?
Yeah, I would just say that in addition to what you've talked about with the steroid testing policy and the opioid video, and we have a lot of subcommittees on the NJSIAA, and one of them is a committee called the Medical Advisory Committee, and I believe that's made up of doctors and sports medicine people and athletic trainers And we get a lot of recommendations through them in terms of player safety and keeping athletes, you know, medically healthy. And in addition to the things that Larry's talked about already, I mean, we have other initiatives as well. We're just in the process of, we just had a first reading on a newly adopted heat participation policy that's going to hopefully keep the kids safer in terms of really hot weather. You mentioned, Ray, about the restrictions that we've recently enacted or in the process of enacting in terms of live contact and football practice. We have hydration testing for wrestlers so that we don't have kids cutting weight in an unhealthy way. Actually, we're moving to a more advanced technology in that area with an ultrasound scan. So we have anti-hazing resources that are available to coaches and athletes. So there's a whole vast array of ways in which we're looking to keep kids safe and keep kids healthy and make, you know, high school athletics a positive experience for everybody with limited injury and limited illness.
No, before we go on, I just want to, if anyone's listening, you can dial 1-347-989-8904 and press 1, and Michael will get your topic, and I'll pass it on to our guests. We're talking to Larry White and Steve Schofield from the NJSIAA, or you can just type it in the chat room. One other thing, you sparked a little interest, Steve. So you have these subcommittees. So I guess some, particularly in the medical field where we get new information all the time, this is something that's an ongoing process to look at every year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, as long as I've been here, and I probably believe that the Medical Advisory Committee has been part of NJSIA as one of the subcommittees, as Steve said, of the executive committee and everything. They've probably been 20, 25, maybe even 30 years or so. But, it's a committee that's been formed, and we meet in the fall, winter, and spring, and we look at a myriad of different, you know, medical topics. And that group also puts on workshops for, you know, whether it's athletic trainers, maybe coaches, maybe just anybody that wants to, you know, sit in. So it's a very active body, and we have some of the top doctors, especially our orthopedic people, are just, you know, top notch, and they do a fantastic job of making sure that we are consistently on the forefront of, you know, anything to make sure our student athletes are healthy and safe.
You know, we started this conversation. We talked about the importance of athletics, and to the student, to a lot of students, I know for me, sometimes that relationship with your coach is one of the most important relationships you'll have in the school. Years later, I see my coach, and I still call him coach. But do you do any training, and how do you work with the coaches, depending on in all the sports?
Well, we have most of our sports, there are separate coaches associations. Then we have the NJFCA, which is the New Jersey Football Coaches Association. We have the Wrestling Association. And for the most part, as I said, many of our sports have their own bodies that, you know, they meet, discuss, whatever. We also, though, have our coaches association, and one of the big things that we do is to set up programs for them to take courses such as the fundamentals of coaching, which the NFHS, the group that I've mentioned prior to this, you know, has developed huge amounts of coaching courses, officiating courses, you name it, it's out there. And as I said, we've kind of said, you, especially as a new coach, you have to take this fundamental of coaching course through the NFHS. We have former ADs that teach the course. We also have required them that they have to take CPR, AED, and first aid, so that because there's oftentimes, you know, they may not have the trainer because they're at an off-site facility, off-site meaning not at the school. So they, in turn, have to know how to use an AED, perform CPR. And it's those things that, you know, we have regulated to make sure that our coaches are, you know, prepared if there's an emergency.
Right. And, you know, also in addition, like Mr. White had previously stated, the concussion awareness training, that happens every year. There's a heat acclimatization awareness and wellness training that happens every year. All coaches must take it. In addition to that, though, NJSIA has, for a long time, for years and years, has sponsored clinics in individual sports for coaches to just get better at coaching the fundamentals and coaching the strategies of their individual sports. And these clinics are held, you know, all around the state on a regular basis. And there's a host of coaching courses that are offered by the National Federation of High Schools that are accessed, you know, through their website, online courses. I have attended quite a few of the NJSIAA clinics and over the years, and always walk away from them thinking that they were extremely worthwhile and that I gained a lot of information, and it was helpful in my coaching career, for sure.
Okay, and sometimes you get people who are new to coaching when they, you know, their first job may be as a teacher, and they have some experience, but they may not have the complete experience
right.
as a coach. So it's probably pretty helpful.
It is.
Absolutely.
Larry, I think you mentioned before you worked with the officials. There's a partnership with the training of officials, too, with the association?
Yes. Most definitely. There's roughly 90-some what we call chapters of the Officials Association. That's 90-some for all of our sports. And that number, I think, surpasses about 10,000 officials. So one of the major roles that I had was that for the fall sports, we would go around to the state, usually about six or seven different high schools would allow us to hold our preseason officiating meetings for, you know, soccer, football, volleyball, and even wrestling and going around for that one in the winter and basketball. So we'd go around, go over the new rules, but also go over the NJSIA rules in terms of sportsmanship policies. I know several years ago we rolled out our sportsmanship policy that basically we said we were not going to tolerate the trash talking and the language that's used and everything. And, you know, I actually spoke at a national convention. A lot of the people there were saying, yeah, well, dream on type thing. And, you know, but I've also said that after 30 years in the classroom with high school student athletes and high school students, period, they're the best. That's the best age. And, you know, for several years, we would have no disqualifications because of the trash talking and everything. And, you know, when we reported that back out, and, you know, I think people kind of went like, wow. It's like, well, yeah. I mean, I think if you you know, set the bar at 3 feet, people come up to the bar. If you set it at six, they'll come up to the bar. Here's a case where I think our student athletes really came up to the bar and we set it high. So.
And probably the other point person for you, particularly at the high school, and probably and Steve, I'll ask you to also comment on this, is the role of the athletic director. It's one of the administrative positions that probably creates the most gray hairs.
That's a good way to put it.
No, but they're managing, and you're managing a state, and I was, like, flabbergasted when you said the 10,000 officials that we have in all the sports. But there's a, you know, in a high school, there's a lot of sports going on. What do you see as the role of the athletic director, and how does the association, if possible, try to help them?
Well, you want Larry to take this, or
well, Steve,
Larry,
why
don't you comment? Okay, all right.
Okay, you take it first this time.
Okay. All right, my turn. The athletic director, you know, basically the athletic director working with the district and the building administration is tasked with overseeing a meaningful and comprehensive athletic program that serves the district, serves the students of the district. It's a difficult job because there's so many balls to juggle: staffing, officials, busing, eligibility, student-athlete issues, parent issues, what have you. So there's a lot going on. I did the job for a short time, for about 2 years. It's a very high-profile job, but it can be a very, very rewarding job. There is oftentimes no rest for the weary. What I found in my experience of doing it was, because I was an inexperienced athletic director, I relied on the NJSIA quite a bit. I would phone down there often, several times a week, just to make sure that I was doing the right thing, that I was covering my bases the way I needed to be covered, and that I was on top of things. And for an inexperienced athletic director like myself, the NJSIA, being able to pick up a phone and call down there was invaluable to me. Now, one of the things that the NJSIA has done recently to aid new athletic directors is they've begun a mentorship program where anybody that's a new athletic director is mentored by an experienced athletic director. It's a mandatory program, but it's been really, really helpful, I think, in the area of developing athletic directors, because it is a very, very consuming job, athletic director, and it's very high profile.
And, Steve, let me add to that that one of the reasons that it has, I think, even grown more so in the past 15, 20 years than it was when I went, and I won't say how long ago, is because it's not just an athletic director's position anymore. It's
right.
Also maybe that they're the athletic director in charge of activities and whatever as a vice principal.
Could be discipline, could be an athletic director / assistant principal. So the jobs get just increasingly more demanding.
Right. I mean, so, you know, whereas in the past, a lot of times, you know, with an athletic director's job, they would might get in around noontime or something like this. Now, many of these athletic directors, they're getting in at 7:30 in the morning because they have to make sure that the bus is there for the debate team to get, you know, to where they're going and so forth and so on. And it really is a 365-day, 24/7 job. I mean, and I think what we're seen somewhat, though, is it's a little bit of burnout.
Mm-hmm.
We also see that some of the younger men and women, they get into it for the athletic director's position, but within about 6-10 years, they're then looking to go up that, you know, that ladder to become a principal and then maybe a superintendent and so forth and so on. So we are seeing a kind of a turnover there. And plus, we're just seeing a lot of the guys that have been doing it for 25, 30 years. It's like, hey, guess what? It's time to go. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, we do a lot of training with our athletic directors, especially when it comes to the eligibility rules of NJSIA, because that's one of the areas where when I was doing those workshops and everything, I would always say it's better for us, better for them to call us than for us to call them.
Right. And, Steve, and maybe you can talk as a board member, because I don't know if a lot of board members know the – I mean, they may know it, but they may not really take it to heart, the hours that probably an athletic director puts in terms – because all the events are after school,
all right,
weekends.
Yeah.
And so
well,
it's probably
Larry,
one of
Larry.
The
– Larry was alluding to that you know, what a demanding job it is. I mean, it's not uncommon. And I certainly, when I was coaching, worked for people, Lou Paragallo being one, that I could say this is very true of. He would be in, like Larry said, 7:30 in the morning, And oftentimes he's not leaving to go home until 9 or 9:30 at night after the basketball game's done and the bleachers have been pushed in and the lights are getting turned out. That was a normal day for him and for many athletic directors. It's a very, very demanding job, but it's a job that people tend to really love. I mean, if you have a passion for high school athletics, it's something that you want to be involved in, you want to be around.
Yep.
And in the case of Lou Paragallo, he was the athletic director at Johnson for over 35 years and put in days like that more often than not. It's a demanding job, but it can be a very rewarding job as well, an extremely rewarding job.
You go ahead, Larry.
I was just going to add a little story. I remember one of the gentlemen that I was teaching and coaching with towards the end of my teaching and coaching career before I got my master's and became an administrator and then started working here. But he got his degree so that he'd become an athletic director. We stayed in touch, and we would often play each other in terms of where he was now as the AD and where I was still teaching and coaching. And it was funny because over the years, you know, he was really at first, he was really into like, you know, winning, you know, it was like, oh, you know, what team? And I could see him like going through, like he was still coaching. 15 years later, you know, I bump into him. How's it going? And basically he said, you know what now? He says, I just make sure that everything runs perfectly. There's no problems. There's no nothing. Sure, we still like to win, but if we don't, it's not the end of the world. It's just you get to that point where it's like, let's just make sure everything goes according to Hoyle and then get up and do it again the next day.
Yeah.
One of the last issues, we've been talking kind of positively, but there are compliance issues, eligibility issues, where people maybe don't call you first. How do you handle those compliance issues?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, as you said, they don't call us first. And oftentimes, you know, we have to make a call because we've become aware of a situation. It could be because it's reported in the newspaper or, I mean, the past several years anymore, we get so many anonymous contacts. It just gets to the point where it's like, oh, my goodness. I mean, you know, but when we get it and we call the principal and the athletic director, for the most part, tell them that we've heard of a situation. We ask them to investigate, pretty much be timely in that investigation, and then send that written investigation into us. And then, generally speaking, we have five assistant directors. Each one has 2, 3, maybe 4 sports they oversee. And in that particular situation, if it's, say, a football situation, then it would go to the director that's in charge of football. We do a thorough investigation. We may have to have a hearing through our controversies committee come in and decide. And, you know, there may be some punishment that we have to put on the school. Oftentimes we'll ask for a corrective action plan, a CAP, so that to make sure that they don't fall down that wrong path. Again, with our student athletes, we have an eligibility appeals committee in terms of sometimes when maybe somebody has played an eligible student. But, you know, it's all carried out through the constitution and bylaws of the NJSIA. And one of the big things that, you know, we'd like to, you know, I think it's important for people to understand is that the directors here, we don't make the rules. The schools actually are the people that make the rules. When they, you know, voted 300-something to 4 the last December, when we had about 8 different proposals in to change our co-op program, that was the membership speaking. That wasn't Larry White, executive director, or stuff like that. So I think people sometimes don't understand that. It's like, oh, you're the executive director, you can do whatever. It's like, no, I can't.
Yeah, I would echo that. I would say that, recently you know, with the restricted contact rules in football that are in the process of being adapted, there was a lot of play in the press about that. And really, you know, that was initiated by the football coaches themselves. This was, you know, the NJSIA, at times it's a top-down thing because things come through to us from the National Federation that we have to pass down to the schools. But more often than not, it's a bottom-up thing. It's initiatives are being originated, and they're getting their start among the coaches and from the schools themselves. And they find their way, they make their way to the NJSIA. So that's an important point I think I wanted to make sure I got across today.
And probably people should know that. And for board members, it's kind of like we have a delegate assembly where the boards vote on the policy. And it's kind of the same way with NJSIA where the members vote on the policy.
Very correct. Similar.
Yep.
Yes, okay. Well, you know what? Our time is up. It went pretty fast. So I'd like to thank you, Larry White, Executive Director, for joining me. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you for having me, Ray. It was a pleasure.
And Steve, Steve Shofi, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for joining us on this program.
Thanks, Ray. I really enjoy it.
Okay, thank you. And that brings us to the end of this program. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.